More than 3 million gallons of crude oil may be threatening California's central coast. The oil was the cargo of a tanker called the Montebello. Here's the catch. The ship was sunk more than half a century ago by a Japanese submarine not long after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Now there's an expedition to determine just how much of a threat the Montebello still poses as she rests about 6 miles from shore. NPR's Ina Jaffe has our story.
It was another stunning day on California's central coast. In the water were sea lions, otters, pelicans, and more of the varied wildlife this region's known for. On shore, there was a gaggle of folks in uniforms of blue and beige next to the Coast Guard station on Morro Bay. They're members of a combined state and federal task force charged with evaluating the environmental risk posed by the Montebello. The group was put together a couple of years ago at the urging of State Senator Sam Blakesley.
I actually was reading in my local weekly newspaper about this amazing history of a shipwreck that occurred off our coast and that described the fact that there are still maybe 3 million gallons of oil down at the bottom of the ocean. And no one in all the 70 years had really stepped up and said, it's our responsibility to understand what the threat is to the coast.
In fact, for most of the last 70 years, most people didn't even know the oil tanker was down there.
I didn't even talk about it because I was called a liar.
That's Richard Quincy. He's 92 years old and the last surviving member of the crew of the Montebello. They knew the voyage would be dangerous, says Quincy. They even took a vote on whether or not they wanted to go. But with the nation at war,
everyone had to give something, and that was our decision. That, well, this is part of what we do.
On the morning of December 23rd, just before dawn, Quincy was on watch when he saw the outline of a Japanese sub in the water. Then came the torpedo.
It was dark when we got hit. It went so fast that it was hard to keep track of time. We were anxious to get off because we figured that it was going to catch fire.
But the ship didn't catch fire because the torpedo struck the Montebello in front of the oil tanks. Everyone on the crew escaped in lifeboats. And the ship went to the bottom nearly intact, says Robert Schwemmer, a marine historian with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He's seen the Montebello from a manned submersible twice, once in 1996, again in 2003.
Like it just left the dock, except the fact that the upper wheelhouse is missing. So we have 90% of the Montebello sitting there squarely on its keel. Question is the oil on board?
Schwemmer called on his cell phone from the Nanook, which is the mothership, so to speak, for the investigation that's supposed to answer that question. It's owned by Global Diving and Salvage, and it sailed down from Seattle and then basically parked above the Montebello. On board are unmanned remote-operated vehicles, or ROVs, that are being sent below to study the wreck. Schwemmer said they can do a better job than the manned submersibles.
When you do a submersible survey, you're always moving. The ROV allows us to actually come up to different locations and stay on station and study them in more detail.
And a detailed assessment of the threat posed by the Montebello is important to more than just California's coast. Carrie Walsh, project manager with Global Diving and Salvage, says that's because the Montebello's not the only potentially polluting wreck that's been identified by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
This wreck represents the first one in many hundreds of wrecks that NOAA's looking at that are around the United States that have oil in them.
Those wrecks are strewn along both the east and west coasts. And the detailed examination of the Montebello could be a blueprint for evaluating them, says Walsh. There are a lot of steps in that evaluation. First, the ROV cleans portions of the Montebello's hull, then uses ultrasound to measure the thickness of the metal.
Once that's done, then we bring in the nuclear tool, which is a diagnostic scan device. And we press that up against the hull and we measure through the steel. And we can detect by the return signal from the neutron backscatter what's behind it.
So you would get one kind of signal if it was seawater and another kind of signal if it was oil.
Correct.
But they'll want to confirm those results. So Walsh says Global Diving and Salvage is also taking samples from the cargo tanks with the tool they've invented that both drills into the tank and plugs the hole.
And if that doesn't work, we have another device that's a magnetic patch that will seal it up forever.
And if it turns out that the Montebello is still carrying her cargo of crude, The biggest challenge of all may be figuring out how to protect the sensitive central coast from the threat lying 900 feet below the waves. Ina Jaffe, NPR News.
Our program is directed by Greg Dixon, edited by Corey Turner and Allison McAdam, and produced by Matt Martinez. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. The engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson.
Our planning editors are Jerry Holmes and Julia Buckley. The staff includes Art Silverman, Jonathan Baer, Rob Ballinger, Brendan Banizak, Theo Balcom, Melissa Gray, and Jessica Deal.
Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. The managing editor for NPR News is David Sweeney. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The Occupy Wall Street protests that have spread across the country and around the world have taken up many different causes, but the protests share some common themes, including the gap between the rich and the poor. Once you adjust for inflation, the median income in this country has stagnated for about 38 years, almost two generations, even as people at the top have grown wealthier. In a book called The Price of Civilization, the economist Jeffrey Sachs critiques that gap.
It means that for the typical young person right now who is a high school graduate but on average will not get a bachelor's degree, life is extremely challenging to find a foothold with a stable job, with an opportunity to have a reliable income, health and other benefits, and a chance to have the kind of middle-class life that we once took for granted.
Jeffrey Sachs argues that tax cuts have mainly helped the wealthy, while cutbacks in government investments have harmed the economy, made the U.S. less competitive. He says he wants to shift money away from defense spending into things like roads and schools. It is a liberal critique of U.S. policies, though Sachs also thinks proposals like President Obama's jobs plan are just short-term fixes.
I'm emphasizing a point that was very well known and well appreciated in the boom times of America in the 1950s and 1960s, that an effective society, one that is highly productive, one that is inclusive with the broad middle class, and one that is environmentally sustainable, needs, of course, a market economy as its engine of development, but it needs an effective government as well. If we're going to have a society that is fair between rich and poor, we can't leave vast parts of our society to suffer in a poverty trap where young people grow up poor and then don't have the means to make it into the middle class because they can't meet college tuition, for example.
I want to ask about a criticism of your book that was printed in the Wall Street Journal. It was a review of the book, really, by Congressman Paul Ryan, Republican of Wisconsin. And he frames your book as having a completely different view of the role of government than he does. He describes your book. I want you to have an opportunity to respond to it. He describes you as saying that for people to be happy, their government must increasingly shield them from the challenges of life. Is that your view of government?
No, it's not my view of government. My view of government is that government helps to empower us as productive individuals, as healthy people, as well-educated people, businesses that can be competitive internationally, and it helps to do it in a way that's fair and inclusive and environmentally sound. From the early days of our republic, whether it was building the canals or the land-grant universities, we've understood that government is part of the process of making us productive, fair, and sustainable.
And what do you say to the argument, a very simple argument, response to books like yours? Sorry, can't afford it. We got a deficit here.
The precise point is that money and wealth has accumulated so much at the top that it's time for the wealthiest and richest and most powerful people in this country to play their proper role, to have the civic virtues to support America's recovery.
Civic virtues. You want people to have different values than they've had, you think?
I want the people at the top to have responsibility once again. First, to follow the law, because this has been an era of corporate recklessness and scandal. and illegality. And so part of civic virtue is being lawful once again. But another part of civic virtue is sharing in the responsibility of our society. And I believe that the richest and most powerful people have done very well over the last 30 years, but they have not done right for the American people, and it's time that they do.
Jeffrey D. Sachs is the author of The Price of Civilization. Thanks very much.
Oh, I'm delighted. Thank you.
And you can read an excerpt from Jeffrey Sachs' book at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. And now let's talk about the smartphone business, which has several parts to it. There's the hardware, like the guy I saw yesterday who just bought his first iPhone. There are the phone contracts. And then there are the apps, meaning the programs you can download on the phone, sometimes for free, sometimes for 99 cents or a few dollars. We got a review of a few apps from Farhad Manju. He writes for Slate.com and hosts a video series called Killer Apps. He's also a new dad, which means he's often awake in the middle of the night. A good time to try out new apps. Let's talk about some of the things that you could do with a baby on one arm, if necessary. There's an app here called Postagram, and the logo looks like a little stamp. What is it?
Yeah, so Postagram is based sort of on another very popular iPhone app called Instagram. And what Postagram does is it takes your photos from Instagram, and you can also take photos from anywhere else on your iPhone or Facebook, and it turns those photos into real-life postcards. So you can put in someone's address and mail them a postcard of your photo.
So if the baby has fallen asleep in one arm and you got the phone with the camera in it, of course, in the other arm, you could just snap a shot of the baby and send it off to grandma, basically, as a postcard.
Yeah, yeah. And in it'll 4 or 5 days, she'll get it and be very happy about it.
Now, while dealing with the baby on one arm, have you also played this game, and I'm going to it now on the iPhone in my hand, called Anthill?
Yeah, this is a blast, this game. It sort of has the thing that I love most about iPhone, and this is also available on the iPad, games for these devices, which is that they can be kind of tremendously, instantly addictive.
Mm-hmm.
So Anthill, what you do is you are basically defending an anthill. You basically draw lines on the screen to send your worker ants to go get food, and then you draw lines to send your warrior ants to go attack all these other bugs that try to attack your anthill.
Oh, there we go. Hold on. I have instructions from the manager of the worker ants telling me where...
Yes, he's a taskmaster, and he's basically telling you how to direct your ants. It's totally fun. It starts out easy, but then in a few levels, it gets really difficult and kind of frustrating, but in a fun way.
Well, I'm feeling a little sedentary, so why don't I push on this app called Runkeeper, and the logo is someone who looks like they're running.
So Runkeeper started as a way for runners to keep track of their runs, and now it's for other kinds of exercise, too, for walking, for biking, for swimming.
Rather than having that mileage clicker on my hip, I'd be carrying this phone, and it's going to be
right, exactly. So you carry the phone, you start the app, and it uses the GPS chip in the phone to figure out where you were, where you started from. It also can tell how fast you're going. I mean, the great thing is that it does this automatically, so each time you run, it just keeps this data, and then you can go back and look at runkeeper.com, and it keeps a very detailed list of all your stats.
It also says here there's a function inside this program, post to Twitter, post to Facebook, so I can announce to the world that I ran 13 miles or that I actually got rather tired of the whole exercise after about 4 blocks and walked home. Either way, it'll be on.
Yeah, I mean, I think the theory is that if people are looking at your runs, and if you're kind of sharing them with other people, you might be motivated to actually keep up with the running because you might want to impress other people.
Well, once we finish our rigorous exercise, we can go try this other app on the smartphone, which is called Chef's Feed. And there's a subtitle on here now that I've loaded it. And the subtitle is, I'll have what they're having. Is that the whole deal?
This is an app that's kind of designed exclusively for foodies. And so Chef's Feed works. It's a review app like Yelp, for example, where it tells you various restaurants to go to, but the only reviewers here are famous chefs. So it tells you the places that, you know, chefs you might admire go to themselves. Not their own restaurants, other restaurants.
Oh, okay. Looks like I can do New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, some other places, San Francisco.
Yeah, and they, on the website, they say they're going to be adding more cities soon. But right now, it's just the big cities.
Are apps getting so pervasive they're changing our lives?
I think so, especially if you sort of consider the way they occupy time that you otherwise would have been
thinking.
Thinking, walking without having a screen in front of your face. So I think in that way they are.
Farhad Manjoo is the technology columnist for Slate. Thanks very much.
Cool. Thanks so much.
The Finger Lakes region of New York is named for its 11 long, skinny lakes, and the surrounding hills provide fertile ground for grapes. The area is gaining recognition as a wine region, but Finger Lakes wines are not that easy to buy, as we hear from Julie Phillip of member station WXXI.
Grapes have been growing wild in the Finger Lakes for untold centuries. The vines are hardy, able to withstand occasional sub-zero temperatures. But the small purple fruit they bear doesn't lend itself to the making of wine.
You're not going to make a wine out of native grapes that is meant to be consumed in the same meal with some of the great wines of the world.
Evan Dawson is author of a book called Summer in a Glass, The Coming of Age of Winemaking in the Finger Lakes. He says the great wine grapes, those centuries-old European varieties, didn't arrive here until the 1950s. After a lot of trial and error, vintners started making things happen. But for decades, the rest of the wine industry failed to take notice. When it came to wine scores, nothing made here earned that coveted 90 points or above. Until 2008.
There was a 90-point score for one wine. And then early in 2009, three more. And now it's happening with regularity.
Once a wine hits that mark, it gets a lot more attention. This year, Wine Spectator and two other popular wine magazines published big feature stories about the region.
To have all three of those in one year is an indication that there's something hot going on. There's something really finally starting to turn when it comes to public awareness.
The interest and accolades are welcome, but they don't necessarily translate into sales. It's early on a Friday morning, and John Martini is in the warehouse at Anthony Road Winery. He's loading cases of his wine into a big black van. Martini's taking them here, to the Union Square Public Market in Lower Manhattan. It's a 10-hour round trip.
It does mess up my weekends. But as I tell people, the money's good and the show is great.
Martini sells about 20 cases of wine at the market each week. He calls Brian Lewis his best customer. Lewis buys a lot of wine here. He likes to uncork it when he entertains.
It disappears. It's excellent. It's excellent.
But this market is the only place he can find it in New York City. Winemakers in the Finger Lakes typically expand their markets face-to-face, one customer, one restaurant, one retailer at a time. There are a lot of reasons for this. Jim Treesice is president of the New York Wine and Grape Foundation. He says the region still only makes 0.2% of the world's wine, so there's a lot of competition out there. International distribution is just a dream at this point, and only a few Finger Lakes wines can be found in other states.
Because every time you cross a state line, you're dealing with a different country when it comes to wine marketing. It's a different bureaucracy, tax structure, paperwork, headaches, and so forth.
Because well-known wines sell faster, even some local restaurants and liquor stores don't carry many, if any, Finger Lakes wines. You can't find it at local grocery stores either. It's against state law for them to sell wine. But still, new wineries open every year. There are more than 100 now. Martini says he sometimes feels like he's part of a grand experiment.
But when you get a good crop, and you get, in our case now, get a great wine, you don't have to smoke anything to feel good.
In addition to making wine, he says, he's making history. For NPR News, I'm Julie Phillip.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. On Friday, News Corp will hold a long-planned annual meeting for shareholders. After months of scandal, the meeting will offer a forum for a growing chorus of dissident shareholders. They're intent on challenging Rupert Murdoch's grip on the company
But as NPR's David Folkenflik reports, they also face long odds.
The bill of grievances is long and growing. Start with News Corp's legal and financial exposure from the British phone hacking and police corruption scandal that led the company to close a profitable tabloid. Throw in the loss of the nearly $13 billion takeover deal of BSky B, the largest broadcaster in the UK. Recall, too, the charges of nepotism that followed the purchase of the production company of Murdoch's daughter, Elizabeth. She personally pocketed more than $200 million.
If you had this happen at a normal company, in theory, the board would have required the CEO to resign.
That's Laura Martin, senior media analyst for the investment bank Needham & Company. But as Martin points out, News Corp is not just any company, and its leader is not just any CEO.
Do they think the shares that they own are going to go up more if Rupert Murdoch is displaced or less?
Several major institutional investors are pushing for change. Two California state employee pension funds will vote their shares against reappointing Rupert Murdoch to the board. The Amalgamated Bank, which owns a million shares, filed a lawsuit against the company in which it is citing, quote, a culture run amok within News Corp and a board that provides no effective review or oversight. Along with Rupert Murdoch, who is chairman and CEO, the board includes his sons James and Lachlan, along with a half dozen current and former company officials and others with close connections. Plans for Elizabeth Murdoch to join the company's board were shelved. Not good enough, says Robert McCormick. He's the chief policy officer for Glass Lewis, which advises investors on governance issues.
You know, there's the basic statutory definition of independence, usually governed by stock exchanges. But then there's the more real-world definition of independence. You know, if you're best buddies, if you're, golf partner, or a former employee, how independent is that person really going to be when their former boss is someone that they're, in effect, charged with overseeing?
Glass Lewis advised clients who hold shares in News Corp to vote against six directors, including James and Lachlan Murdoch, though not the father. McCormick says the problem with the company can be found in the makeup of the board.
The fundamentals of the firm, the success of the firm, are evident and longstanding. So I think the overthrow the founder, CEO, and an entire management team is probably not warranted at this point.
The math just about assures that any such efforts will fail. The company has a two-tiered ownership structure, so the Murdochs control about 40% of the votes, even though they own just 12% of the company. The next largest shareholder, a Saudi prince, is standing squarely behind Murdoch, too. But James Murdoch's actions while running News Corp's British operations and his testimony before Parliament this summer have been called into doubt. During a conference call with analysts and reporters in August, I asked Rupert Murdoch about how the company was run and the independence of the oversight of the company's promised internal inquiry into phone hacking.
You mentioned that you and the board affirmed it would be right that you would continue on as chairman and CEO of the corporation. That said, there are a lot of ties, familial, corporate, and financial, between yourself, members of your immediate family, the board, and those responsible for the internal inquiry. What do you say to those analysts who contend that your company...
That's not true.
Murdoch said Viet Dinh, a director, would provide scrupulous oversight of that inquiry. Dinh is a former assistant U.S. attorney general, but is also the godfather to one of Murdoch's grandchildren.
He's a completely independent director, a distinguished lawyer. You know, I can just assure you that we continually evaluate our corporate governance practices and have engaged outside counsel to confirm that we are in compliance with standards of good corporate governance.
Meanwhile, investigations into the scandals continue unabated. Over the next 6 days, former executives for News Corp's British arm will testify before a parliamentary committee. And James Murdoch is expected to be called back to face more questions himself next month. David Folkenflik, NPR News.